Our next guest has covered Donald Trump for over two decades. He's currently the chief White House correspondent for ABC News, and he chronicles it all in his new book, Front Row at the Trump Show. He's Jonathan Karl from ABC News. John, thanks so much for taking the time today.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with where we're at right now. It's been another tumultuous few weeks for the White House. The president made the habit of speaking and taking questions at the coronavirus task force briefings, then announced he would be canceling them. Then we heard they'd be coming back, but scaled back. Now it seems that they've kind of rebranded it into these press conferences, into these daily press conferences. Where's the White House at on its messaging right now?
Well, the president announced on Friday via Twitter that these press briefings were a total waste of time, you know, blaming people like me and the news media, and White House officials were saying, look, he wasn't going to be doing these things as a regular thing anymore. I actually went on and had an interview on CNN's Reliable Sources on Sunday. So right after he did this, and I said, look, I will believe it when I see it. And sure enough, on Monday, we had another full press conference. I think that the president has gotten incredibly frustrated with the media coverage of this. And I think that's because he has seen this crisis as largely a communications challenge, how to communicate that he is doing a great job handling the crisis. And when he went out and had his briefing on Thursday and he floated that idea of disinfectants and could they be used inside the body and maybe injected some way and could we test that, you know, the reaction was total ridicule. And there's nothing that Donald Trump hates more than being ridiculed. And that's what prompted this talk of, you know, maybe we should scale it back. But I've got to tell you, he knows that he can take a few steps outside of the Oval Office and have all of the cameras there to see him in the Rose Garden, take a few more steps, go into the briefing room. It's literally 25 steps from the door to the Oval Office, and have cameras broadcast his message all around the country, all around the world. And he frankly cannot resist that. So I think we'll be seeing him one form or another still out there before the press very often.
John, this is Dave McEwen. If I could jump in here, if we kind of think of the book and kind of pan out for Donald Trump as president, he clearly and his team clearly have changed how they deal with the press and how they see the press. You talk about this throughout the book, of course, even treating the press and the media so far as to calling it, you know, the opposition party, for example. How has this presidency permanently changed the relationship between the press and the institution of the presidency, in your view?
Well, what I outline in the book, because I don't think people are aware of it, is the extent to which Donald Trump courts the news media and courts the very reporters that he vilifies, that he casts as traitors to our country, disgusting people, fakers, make everything up. And then you turn around and he's actually incredibly accessible, very complimentary. I mean, he has said the nicest things about me and then gone out and, you know, and called me, what was it, cutie pie, wise guy, third-rate reporter, I'll never make it. I mean, all in the space of a week. But he actually is a consumer of news beyond which I have ever seen, certainly in a president, but I think in any public figure I've ever covered. He once told me that the TiVo, you know, the early DVR, was the greatest invention or one of the greatest inventions of mankind. The DVR, he gets to watch it all. He gets to watch, you know, Fox Live because he loves that. But he'll watch MSNBC. He'll watch CNN. He'll certainly watch the network morning shows, the network evening shows. He reads the newspapers. He wants to consume everything that is said about him. How does it permanently change things? Well, you know, I first and foremost in the book, I wanted to describe this story because I've known him for 26 years now. And I have had some incredibly fascinating interactions with him. I have had him scream at me in private, profanities. Like I said, I have had him, you know, call me up in the most cordial way and, you know, and give me a story. I've had him. I've just witnessed him in many different ways that I have not been able to describe in my day-to-day reporting. Because, you know, there's such the crush of news. I wanted to take a step back and give people a sense of what it's like. But at the end of the book, I do warn that we may have changed things in a very negative way in this country, and perhaps a disastrous way, because we have created a situation where the whole notion of truth is eroded. So we have a good chunk of the country that will not believe anything that comes out of this White House, no matter what. It's just the default position. He has said so many things that are untrue that I'm not going to believe anything. And then we have another good chunk of the country that won't believe anything they see in a newspaper or see in a television news report, unless it's an outlet that comes from their point of view. And that's disturbing. I mean, we need to be able to at least have a common understanding of what the facts are if we're to have any chance whatsoever of overcoming our deep divisions. And I don't know that that does snap back to normal when this is over. I really don't.
Now, as you mentioned, you've covered Trump for over two decades. When he says some of these more outrageous statements, say the injecting yourself with disinfectants or things like that, how many of these things that he says, or in terms of policy, how much of that comes from him, and how much of that comes from voices around him talking to him, save the Giulianis or the Stephen Millers or even Mike Pence, those type of voices around him? How much is he influenced by that, and how much is coming from him?
I think that Donald Trump drives almost all of this. So you mentioned Stephen Miller. Stephen Miller came to work for Donald Trump pretty early on, but it wasn't until January of 2016. Keep in mind, and Stephen Miller's the hardline immigration voice in the White House, right? But is he, or is Donald Trump the hardline immigration voice inside the White House? How did Donald Trump announce, what did he say when he announced his campaign, a half a year before he hired Stephen Miller or even had any idea who Stephen Miller was? His whole thing about the Mexicans, they're rapists, they're bringing drugs. Donald Trump drives the message here. He does listen to people. He does have people he talks to. But something like this disinfectant thing, that is pure Donald Trump. He thinks he goes from the gut. He had this phrase. I recount this interview he did with Barbara Walters in 1987. Okay, so this is ancient history. He's in his early 40s, I believe, and he's made a trip to New Hampshire, and people are saying, "Oh my God, could this young, brash, entrepreneur, developer, run for president?" And Barbara Walters is trying to get at what his strategy is, what he's trying to do, and he says the prize fighters have a phrase: you go with the punches. You don't go in there with a plan. You get into the ring. You go with the punches. You don't know what the next 30 seconds are going to be, let alone the next 6 months, 6 years. So that's Donald Trump. He he's his own press secretary. He's his own communications director. He is his own chief of staff. He's his own national security advisor. He has people around him that carry those titles, but he's the one that really drives this.
So, John, as you read the book, and there's so much in there, and there's so many anecdotes about how the White House operates and how Trump directs much of this, the approach of the media, the messaging, whatever it is. One of the things you see in there, and several of the stories and anecdotes that you have, is about the management of the White House, whether that's Kelly, McMaster, Mattis, Tillerson, whatever that looks like. As we move to the next stage here, and Meadows is now the new chief of staff, what are the challenges that he has that are different than previous chiefs of staff have had, or how they've changed their operations of dealing with the president himself and the messaging that comes out of that?
I go back and forth on whether or not chief of staff is the most difficult job in Washington or press secretary, but it's close either way. And I do go through the different styles that the people that have tried to do this before had. And, Reince Priebus was somebody who had political experience, and he went in there, and he wasn't exactly an experienced Washington hand, but he had been the chairman of the party, you know, for a number of years, had gone through a couple presidential elections. He had never worked in a White House. He had never worked on Capitol Hill, but he knew everybody, but he knew people who did. And he was never really had a chance because, you know, he was hired as chief of staff. The press release went out and he was the third name in the press release. It was Steve Bannon is the chief strategist. You know, Jared Kushner, the chief, whatever. And, you know, chief of staff, by the way, is Reince Priebus. So, but he tried and he tried to steer the president and had some modest success along the way and a lot of lack of success. And then John Kelly came in and he's a 4-star Marine general. And the president respects that. And Kelly's got a great reputation. And he's a guy that's run things. You know, he was the head of, of Southcom for the military. He knows how to run things and how to run a tight operation. And he really did try to impose order. And for a while he did. You know, you couldn't get into the White House without going through Kelly. Right. You couldn't get on the president's call list without going through a process. And he also, when the president said crazy things or proposed ideas that were out there, he stopped them. He didn't necessarily confront the president. He often didn't, but he would just kind of yes the president and then quietly put that idea in the trash can. And Kelly did something extraordinary to while I was writing this book. He refused to do an interview with me, which mm-hmm. I found very disappointing because I talked to almost everybody else. But as I was kind of nearing the, you know, really the end of my first draft, I called him up because I had talked to him so many times while he was chief of staff in off the record settings. And there was something he said to me, something specific that I wanted to use in the book. And I said, could you at least, you know, can I use that? And he said to me, anything I told you while I was chief of staff that was off the record, you can use. If I said it, I said it, you can use it. So it really gave me some texture and color as I was reporting on his period. And there's one amazing story very quickly where he's in the Oval Office with H.R. McMaster, who was the National Security Advisor.
Right.
And McMaster is briefing the president on the deteriorating situation in Venezuela. And the president, you know, he didn't really like McMaster. McMaster, like, used too many, you know, he was too much like a drill sergeant. And the president doesn't like to, he wants to be the one talking, not the guy briefing him. So the president just demanded, I want a war plan. What's the war plan for Venezuela? And McMaster started to explain him, well, it's not really a military solution here. We're going to put diplomatic pressure. We've got this. We've got that. I want a war plan, damn it. Where's the war plan? He said, well, sir, I don't think there really is. And ultimately, Trump lost his temper and said, you get to the Pentagon. You get me a war plan. The meeting ends, and McMaster says, yes, sir. And he goes and he starts walking back to his office to contact the Pentagon. And Kelly hurried after him and said, where are you going? What are you doing? He said, well, I'm carrying out an order of the commander in chief. And he said, don't do that. Don't do that. This will blow up. It'll leak and it'll get the Pentagon all. There's no war plan for Venezuela. And that anecdote, when I actually talked to I asked McMaster about it. What he told me is that kind of stuff happened all the time, all the time. McMaster would tell the president, I don't think that's a good idea, but he felt that if the president still wanted to do it, it was his job to either resign or carry out the orders. Kelly did not confront the president as a rule of thumb, but felt that it was his idea just to kind of like take the bad ideas and forget they weren't floated.
Now, you wrote a lot about the president's handling of the Charlottesville incidents and kind of the aftermath of that. Do you see parallels in where we're at now with some of the stay-at-home protests? You know, we're in election season again. Is he having the same reactions to those? Do you see some similarities in the two?
I do, and Charlottesville was really an extraordinary thing I learned in the process of reporting for this book, that, you know, the president made those comments that were really the low point of his first year in office, maybe the low point of his presidency, certainly one of them, where he talked about these these protesters. So we all saw, the world saw, these were, you know, there were neo-Nazis that were protesting. We saw people with the tiki torches saying, "Jews will not replace us." This was a horrific scene. And the president went out in public and said that there were very fine people on both sides of the protests. And what the extraordinary thing I found out is the president gave exactly the same speech, almost word for word, a day earlier to his senior staff. Kelly was there. The new FBI director was there. Jeff Sessions was there. And nobody in the room confronted the president and said, "Sir, it's really not a good idea to say that there are very fine people marching with neo-Nazis, especially after somebody has just been killed by one of these racists who are down there protesting. Not a good idea. Not a good idea to praise Confederate generals at a time when the president is seeing all of this, when the world is seeing all of this." And nobody did that. Nobody, they let him vent in private and thought, well, he would never say that stuff in public, and then he does. But to your question about the comparison to now, I mean, I do think that when the president sees these protesters, they're actually protesting his own policies, because the CDC under Donald Trump has put forth these guidelines on social distancing, and you see these protesters, and they're rebelling against that. And there, some of them are saying that the coronavirus is a myth, that it's, and that's not where the president is. The president may have said things early on that would suggest that, but the president's done some extraordinary measures here that have been recommended by the health experts, and you know, but the president looks at the protesters, and I think maybe a little bit like Charlottesville, he sees those are people who like me. Now, I'm not saying the neo-Nazis are like the Trump supporters, but a lot of the people that were protesting the fundamental issue of taking down Confederate statues were people that supported Donald Trump in that election. And he sees these protesters out there protesting the stay-at-home orders, and he sees many of them actually are wearing Make America Great Again hats. And he wants to, you know, he doesn't want to criticize them.
We were talking with Jonathan Carl of ABC News about his book, his bestseller, Front Row at the Trump Show. And John, as we look at this in the next stage of what happens with the pandemic and the Trump presidency, it seems like the president has set up and really trying to move to that next stage, the grand reopening of America, or whatever we call it. And how do you think that plays out for him, this next stage? He has altered and evolved his presidency at different times and different moments. And with the economy tanking, the new challenges that exist in the midst of an election year are certainly going to challenge his old approach. So what do you expect to see when you're there at the front row with what comes next with this president?
Well, he's clearly very eager to get things opened again, as most of America is. He also does have an ear to what the health professionals are saying. And it's been interesting. There's been often a disconnect between what Donald Trump says or what he tweets and what he actually does, especially on this crisis, because many times over this, remember when he was, you know, weeks ago was saying the cure can't be worse than the problem. And it seemed like, and he was talking about people filling up the pews and churches on Easter Sunday. That stuff didn't happen. I mean, he didn't loosen the restrictions, but I think he's eager to move in that direction right now. And my sense is that the direction he is heading is to leave it up to the governors. This allows him to not take responsibility ultimately for what happens. So if they open up too early and the virus comes back and we're in a big mess, he can, you know, the governors were the ones that did it. If the governors stay closed too long and the economy really hurts, he can blame the governors. I think that a big, you know, or a recurring theme for him throughout this is he wants to take credit for the things that work, but he does not want to take blame for things that go wrong.
Kind of close out with this one. Let me ask you this. For someone who's covered him for so long, one of the parts of his presidency that was always sort of confusing to me is when he first came in, you know, a celebrity president coming into office, I feel like there was a lot of opportunities for him. For someone who's so addicted to ratings and polls and having attention like that, there were so many opportunities to do easy things that you know, would have gotten positive, you know, positive reaction from both sides of the aisle. And he would have, you know, the response he would have gotten as president, you know, it would have been a lot more positive than what he's seeing. Is he also addicted to kind of the conflict also? And he kind of feeds off that as well, that we've never really seen him kind of go for those easy victories like that.
It's such a smart observation. I mean, you could kind of play back what's happened and imagine if he came into office and the first thing he did was to say, we're going to do a big, you know, huge $1 trillion infrastructure program. We're going to rebuild America, you know, would have freaked out some of the Republicans that are concerned about deficits. You know, Democrats who have been pushing for public works programs like this would have been on board, even though it was Donald Trump doing it. He could have had a big bipartisan victory. We could debate the merits of it and what the deficit implications, but it could have been something he had done. He could have done. And there have been other things like that. I mean, he gave that first message to the joint session of Congress, his first State of the Union speech that was so well received and looked like, oh, wow. I mean, some people were saying, wow, he became president today. But, you know, it was 2 days later, he was, you know, back in the muck by accusing Barack Obama of wiretapping Trump Tower. There is a self-destructive streak, to be sure. But I think there's also a sense that he doesn't want to do anything that could even slightly alienate his core supporters. And maybe that's part of what was driving some of the reaction to Charlottesville, even in his mind somewhere. But he doesn't, you know, he wants to keep his most ardent and hardcore supporters happy, or the happiest, those that are cheering him on at those rallies. He doesn't want to do anything that would alienate them in any way. And maybe that's what's driven it. You know, one of his aides during the transition said to me, he's going to be America's first independent president. Because he has no loyalty to the Republican Party establishment, which is true. He didn't at all. I mean, he ran against them. But it just never happened. It never materialized. I mean, he had an opportunity to do that. He could go against the party leaders because he had done it and he got elected president anyway. So he could have done it as president of the United States. And he is just not – that is the road not taken for Donald Trump.
The book is Front Row at the Trump Show. He is Chief White House Correspondent for ABC News. Jonathan Carl, thank you so much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. All right, great talking to you guys.